Okay, welcome back. We are now ready to do the second quantization of a quantum field theory on curved space-time. I think we'll have to... okay, it's gone. Perfect. now it's elsewhere. Let's see. Let's wait until this settles. Okay. Good. So we are now ready to second quantize our Klein-Gordon field on a generic curved space-time. Remember where we arrived. This is the Hamiltonian side. This is the Lagrangian column. And most recently, we considered the Klein-Gordon theory on a generic curved space-time, and then performed the Legendre transform to arrive at the Hamiltonian Klein-Gordon theory on a curved space-time. In the process, we figured out what the canonically conjugate momentum field is, and that means that we are now ready to perform the step of quantizing the Klein-Gordon theory on, on curved space-time. Remember what that entails. We have to perform three tasks in order to solve the theory. We have to solve the canonical commutation relations. We have to ensure the hermeticity conditions. And of course, we have to solve the equations of motion. And the equations of motion are the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, this is the D'Alembert operator on curved space-time. And the relationship, the other equation of motion, is the relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum and the field. So how shall we solve that? Matthias, please close the door. We need a trick to solve that. We need, let's not say trick, but a strategy to solve all of these conditions, hermeticity, canonical commutation relations, and equations of motion. And in order to develop such a strategy, let's take a hint from how we quantize the theory in Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, we found that the quantized field phi can be written in this form, where we have an integral over the three momenta, k, and then we had some space and time dependent functions in front of the annihilation operators a index k and some space and time dependent function in front of the a dagger operator a dagger k. And of course we had the relationship that the canonically conjugate momentum can be easily calculated from phi just by taking the derivative. So what hint can we take from this? Let's just take the overall rough structure of the solution. Overall, what it is a formulation which separates the three tasks that we have to do so that we solve them separately. We solve separately for the hermeticity, separately for the canonical commutation relations, and separately for the equations of motion. Why? Let's look at this term here. All of the non-commutativity is in this operator here, because that's just a function here, right? So the non-commutativity is separated off as an operator here that can have non-trivial commutation relations. So the canonical commutation relation condition eventually, the non-commutativity is encoded here. The dynamics, to have a solution to the equations of motion, that is handled by this prefactor. See, this prefactor here has to be a solution to the equation of motion. If it is, that term will not disturb it because it's a constant thing, right? So it doesn't have any non-vanishing space or time derivatives. So you see, we solve the equations of motion by making sure that this prefactor is solving the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation. And this is just, you know, normalization prefactors that we can then fix. All of the space and time dependence is in here. So the equation of motion, if we solve by making sure that this solves the equation of motion, this stuff is not space and time dependent. The non-commutativity is handled by the A operator. And now how about the hermeticity condition? What we need is that phi is Hermitian. It's a self-adjoint operator valued field. And in order to achieve that, we just take what we have here and add the Hermitian conjugate to it. In this way, under Hermitian conjugation, this term becomes that term, and that term becomes this term, and we are good. So that's the overall strategy that we will now also adopt. We will look for a solution of the second quantization problem that is of this general form. Namely, and I'm writing it here now, some space-time-dependent function multiplying the A operator. This is, again, supposed to take care of the non-commutativity. This function is supposed to take care of the equation of motion. And then we just add the Hermitian conjugate of that, again, so that we get something that's guaranteed to be Hermitian. Just because whatever that is, the Hermitian, if we add the Hermitian conjugate to it, the whole thing is Hermitian. So that's going to be our ansatz. K could be anything. In the case of Minkowski space, K labels the momentum, the three momentum. But in generic curved space-time, Fourier transform is not a thing. You can formally do it, but it matters a great deal whether you first Fourier transform. And then, I mean, it's Fourier transform is just not diffeomorphism invariant. It's just something very weird in generic curved space-time. So we should expect that K is some label that may or may not be related to the Fourier transform.
So,
and just let me just finish the thought. And then, if we get away with this, well, then we define the pi simply to be that. And then we have the canonically conjugate momentum field as well. So the other equation of motion then is kind of given for free. Yes, your question?
In a few lectures ago, we were painting this picture that quantization equals Fourier transform. So we should think that way only in flat Minkowski spacetime.
Oh, excellent question. No, even here, quantization is a Fourier transform. But it's not a Fourier transform from position space to momentum space. It's a Fourier transform from the space of fields into the space of sources. Right? Sources like charges and currents. We have that the partition function is a path integral over phi. It's a path integration over all fields, phi. And then what we get on the left-hand side of the path integral equation, the so-called partition function, depends on J, which is the Fourier partner to phi. And that's still true. That's still just a plain Fourier transform. And that doesn't change, because where we introduced curvature was actually in space, or space-time. That's where we introduced curvature, which is a finite dimensional space, right? It's a four-dimensional space-time. But in the space of fields, phi, which is infinite dimensional, there we are not introducing curvature. It's still canonical to perform a Fourier transform from the phi to the j.
So like that Fourier transform is a path integral, right? So that path integral is still like a diffeomorphic invariant, right?
The Fourier transform that is quantization? Oh, yes. Yes, it is. OK, so that's going to be our ansatz. At this point, you might say, I'm going to try the smart thing, and not sum over k at all. Why don't I just choose one solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, multiply it here, and then here the complex conjugate solution, and multiply it there. And right away, I get two of the three conditions obeyed, because the equation of motion will be obeyed by this phi hat, just because this obeys it and that obeys it. And we have the hermeticity condition. J just the canonical commutation relations, I would have to check. And that's the sticking point, you see? If we just use one function here, we will not be able to make phi and pi obey the canonical commutation relations, as we will soon see. In fact, the canonical commutation relations are the sticking point, which shouldn't be surprising, because solving the Hermiticity condition and the equation of motion classically is not that hard. It's the quantization, it's the implementation of the canonical commutation relations that's the tricky bit. And that's also what will force us to use complex valued prefactor functions. We cannot even get away with real valued functions, even though the classical problem is that of a real valued Klein-Gordon field. And nevertheless, the quantization forces us to have complex valued solutions, and in fact, infinitely many. Not even finitely many will suffice. We need infinitely many solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation here, complex valued solutions. Only then will we be able to do it. So let's see how that all plays out. Yeah?
The key point in doing all of this, what we've done so far, is to first solve the classical covariant Klein-Gordon equation to get the mode profiles that are...
The mode functions, yes. Mode functions. Yeah, we will need the classical solutions, but in fact we will need to combine them into complex solutions. You know, you can just take two real valued functions and take one plus I times the other and you get a complex valued solution. This is possible because the theory doesn't have any other interactions than with gravity. It's only interacting with gravity.
So if I'm just to follow a similar procedure for any field besides the Klein-Gordon field, the first trick lies in actually solving the classical covariant form of it.
Yeah, it's harder actually, because you see, if this was a self-interacting theory even, just with the phi to the 4 term, then it's no longer true that if you have two real-valued solutions, you can just add them up to get a complex-valued solution. Right? Because it's a non-linear equation of motion now. So just because you have one and another solution, the linear combination of the two is no longer a solution. It's no longer a vector space. And in all what we do now, it's very important that we don't have an interaction in there. That interaction can later be treated, but perturbatively.
So I just have a side tangential question. But usually in QED, when they or applied QED, cavity QED or whatnot,
yeah.
If you have some kind of current on the linearity system, they first treat it completely classically, find the so-called mode functions, and then they quantize. But that seems, according to what you're saying, completely wrong.
It depends on the circumstances. Here we wouldn't get away with it.
But in general, nonlinear theories are problematic if you do this procedure.
You can also quantize, to some extent, nonlinear theories. But, I mean, for example, there are so-called skirmions and solitons of all sorts, and a lot of work has gone into that. You don't have to always treat things perturbatively. But in this case, we have to do it perturbatively. See, sometimes you're lucky and you actually know what the classical solutions are to a nonlinear differential equation. And then, yeah, you may be able to do things. But here in gravity, we don't have that luxury. All right, so let's see how far we get with this ansatz. In fact, it will go all the way, but it'll be quite non-trivial. But let's keep in mind, following our discussion now, that this hinges on the assumption that the field doesn't have a potential term. Right? So it can have a potential term as long as it's only quadratic. So a mass term is fine. What we need is that the Klein-Gordon equation is a linear differential equation. If in the action we had a phi to the 4 term, then the Klein-Gordon equation would have a phi to the 3rd term after, you know, the Euler-Lagrange equation gets rid of one power. So we would have a phi to the 3rd term, and that would ruin the linearity of the solution space. The solution space would no longer be a vector space. But as you will see soon, it's absolutely crucial for this method of solving the second quantization problem that we are dealing with a vector space of solutions. So with this ansatz here, we use again A and A dagger operators, and we will make the ansatz that they have the usual commutation relations for A and A dagger operators, namely just Kronecker of K and K prime. It could also be a Dirac delta, but we will try to get away with a Kronecker of k and k prime. And remember that the k doesn't have to be the momentum. It doesn't have to be the Fourier transform variable to x. It could be any index. And the advantage of using these non-commuting operators, if we get away with these ansatz, is that, of course, we know all about generating a Hilbert basis in the Hilbert space from them, by starting with the vector that's annihilated by A and then creating other basis vectors from that. Right, and then, so if we reuse the A and A daggers that we already know, then now we also need some number-valued classical solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, these functions uk of x and t. And they are still to be determined. At the moment, we just assume that we have such solutions available. If need be, we just calculate them numerically. So the uk of x and t are supposed to be, by assumption, they are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We call these functions mode functions. And let's see what we get. Well, let's check the hermeticity condition. Well, we already discussed that. If the uk of x and t and its canonically complex conjugate are solving the equation of motion, and we write this ansatz, then, well, the hermeticity is obvious, right? Because this term, Hermitian conjugate, is that term, and that term, Hermitian conjugate, is this term. So therefore, the Hermitian conjugation of phi gives us phi again. In fact, for testing the hermeticity condition, these functions, the mode functions, don't even have to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. But now let's check that the Klein-Gordon equation also holds, the first equation of motion. Does it hold for this ansatz? And yes, it does, because what we have to check is whether this derivative operator, you know, the whole thing involves derivatives, so we call it the derivative operator, that this derivative operator applied to the phi hat field gives us zero. Well, let's see. If we apply that derivative operator here on the field, then, well, it contains these derivatives, and they will not do anything with that. The derivatives only pick up this, and they will annihilate that, right? So what we get is that this term is annihilated by the derivative operator, and that term is also eliminated by this Klein-Gordon operator. So the equation of motion is holding as well. So it seems that we are making rapid progress here, and we are almost done quantizing the theory. Well, let's see. How far do we still have to go? Well, let's check the second equation of motion. The second equation of motion is this one. Let's see. Well, we simply define the canonically conjugate field pi to be this. And we are done. So then it is also fulfilled. Now, the sticky part. We also need to check that the canonical commutation relations hold. And that's really where the quantization sits. Clearly, the phi commutes with itself, and the pi commutes with itself. That's obvious to see there. But how about the commutator between phi and pi, the equal time commutator between phi and pi? Remember, if we hold a fixed point in time, if we hold a point in time fixed, and we look at two different locations, and we look at the phi and the pi observable at these two different locations, they're supposed to commute, except if they're the same location, and then we have a Dirac delta. In order to check whether or not the canonical commutation relation holds, we simply need to put our phi in here and our pi that we just calculated from up here. We need to put that pi, which is, you know, this derivative thing, applied to the phi into the commutator and evaluate the commutator and see whether on the right-hand side we get I h bar Dirac delta x minus x prime. So the phi we have already expressed in terms of the mode functions, and the pi we have expressed in terms of phi. So pi is this in terms of phi, and phi is this. So what we get is that the pi is this derivative operator acting on phi. So it's a little lengthy what this canonically conjugate pi is. But let's just plug it in. So we plug the phi in terms of its mode functions and so on, the explicit ansatz, we plug that in here, and we plug the expression for pi in there. And then we obtain that the commutator, the equal time commutator between phi and pi, is given by, here we have the phi, and here we have the pi. A lot of terms, but fortunately there's a lot of commuting stuff. Like all the a's commute with all the a's. And all the a daggers commute with all the a daggers. And what we get is only one term where the a, this term with an a, is commuted with that term with an a dagger. And what we get is this expression here, and then the commutator of a with, of ak with a dagger k prime. That gives us a Dirac delta or Kronecker delta between k and k prime, and this as a prefactor. And of course, also that thing in front. So that gives us this term, and then we get that from here, and we get that from there. And then we also have a term where this doesn't commute with that, gives us also a Dirac delta or Kronecker delta. We get the same kind of prefactor, namely this prefactor and that prefactor and that prefactor. And because it's the commutator between a dagger and a, it's not directly a Kronecker delta, it's the minus Kronecker delta, which is why we have a minus sign here. So we have a minus sign, and then we collect the terms. We have this term here, we have this derivative here, and the u star there. So that's what we get here. And nicely, this double sum over k and k prime, because remember, phi has a sum over the k's in it, and pi has a sum over k primes. And so overall, we have a double sum here. But because of these Kronecker deltas, it becomes a single sum. We get rid of the k prime. So then when we write it in terms of a single sum, it's this expression here. And that expression has to be equal to I times, well, I h bar, really, a Dirac delta of x minus x prime, because we want the commutation relations to hold. Now, at this point, we can tell, we can now verify what I discussed briefly earlier, namely that, first of all, we would never get away with just one term here. Like in this ansatz, naively, we could say, well, why don't I just put any solution here to the Klein-Gordon equation? Then if I put just one solution here and don't sum, then I'm guaranteed that this operator obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. It's also Hermitian. But in order to get the canonical commutation relations, I need to have that sum, I said. But why? You see, here we have a function which is a mode function, a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. That's not a distribution. That's an ordinary function. It's an ordinary complex-valued function. And here we have the derivative of it. Ordinary complex-valued function. Here we have, again, such a combination. So this is ordinary function, supposed to be Dirac delta. Cannot be, right? If we have just the product and the sum of ordinary functions, they will never add up to give us a Dirac delta. The only way that we can have a Dirac delta on the right-hand side is if we sum up sufficiently many of these functions. And in fact, any finite sum of continuous, in fact, differentiable functions, any finite sum of differentiable functions will be a differentiable function and will not be a Dirac delta. So in order to have any chance that this ansatz succeeds, we must have that we sum over infinitely many k. We never worried about this before in the Minkowski space because we did the Fourier transform for other reasons, because we wanted to get rid of the derivatives and turn them into multiplications. And then it just so happened that we had, of course, infinitely many momenta. And then, yeah, that all worked out. But now we see that fundamentally, no matter what the situation is, we need infinitely many terms here in order to fulfill the canonical commutation relations. And more than that, we can now also verify the claim that we would not get away with real-valued solutions. There are real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, of course, but we don't get away in this ansatz by doing this. Because imagine if we chose here real-valued functions. Again, hermeticity would be okay, equations of motion would be okay, but the canonical commutation relations not. And the reason is that if uk is uk star, then this term is that term. Right? Then this term is that term, and therefore the whole thing is zero. So in order to obey the canonical commutation relations, we need infinitely many complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And not just that, they have to obey this equation here. And then the question is, how on earth can we find solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that obey that condition? Infinitely many that obey that condition. So the problem of solving the quantization problem, the second quantization problem of the Klein-Gordon theory, boils down to the problem of sifting through the space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, all complex-valued solutions eventually, and then picking out an infinite set of them such that if we sum stuff up in this way, these functions that we obtain in this way, remember there's no operator in this anymore, right? Because all the A's and daggers went away when we commute, when we used the commutator. This is just ordinary functions. We need to find infinitely many ordinary functions that are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that in the limit when you add all of them up, they end up being the Dirac delta. Okay, so the conclusion so far is if we make this ansatz, then that solves the quantum field theory, that is, it solves the hermeticity condition, equation of motion, and the canonical commutation relations if we can find a set of number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation which obeys the condition that this sum of these mode functions gives us I times Dirac delta.
Achim?
Yeah?
Quick question. So is the idea here that we have a space of functions and then we kind of restrict to a subspace that satisfies this relation? Is that the same as what people do, yeah, I don't know, in quantum gravity probably, that they have a Hilbert space of solutions and then they restrict some sort of kinematical Hilbert space or something? That...
Good question. The answer is no. It's a little different. We still will need the entire space of solutions. What we are looking for, we're not diminishing that. What we are looking for is a particular way of spanning that space of solutions. We're looking for a kind of basis in that space of solutions. And then these basis functions we assemble here in this ansatz in order to give us the solution. So it's not a matter of restricting to a subspace. It's a matter of picking a basis. However, it's not as simple as diagonalizing an operator and then getting a basis, an eigenbasis of that operator. It's a more subtle thing. It's almost that, but not quite. So one can ask, under which conditions do we even have a chance to solve this? Does this have solutions no matter what, no matter what space-time? And the answer is, fortunately, almost yes. So if you were hoping that we will build wormholes in space-time in order to travel back into the past and so on, then Well, we couldn't second quantize in this case. But if we exclude this, if we assume that space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic, which is that it possesses a foliation into space-like hypersurfaces that are Cauchy surfaces, or just a sec, or alternatively, if we assume that space-time is of the form of a real time axis, it might not be all of R, but some interval of it, cross some other manifold, then, then it can be done. So if the space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic, so if you have a well-defined Cauchy problem, then you actually can find solutions. That's a theorem that we are not going to prove here. So in this case, space-time, I mean, in the case where the space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic, space-time possesses no closed time-like curves. There is no travel into the past, no wormholes that would allow you to do that. And if you set initial conditions on any one of the Cauchy surfaces, then that determines the solution everywhere in the past and in the future. Under these conditions, if the space-time is well behaved in that sense, then one can prove that such functions, UK, exist. Now, not only do such functions exist, not only is it possible to find such a basis, such that we get the Dirac delta here, no, we have too much of it, in the sense that if there's one, there's infinitely many. So there's not only one choice of these mode functions such that this quantization succeeds. No, there are infinitely many choices such that the quantization succeeds. And we will have to address the problem of picking out one of them. We will have to ask, is it perhaps equivalent? Which one we choose? Or could it be that we have to choose one? Or could it be that while they're all equivalent, some choice might be more convenient? But for now, let's just ask, can we find at all any? Let's just be happy if we can quantize once, if we can quantize with one solution, and then we'll go from there and address the very important question of the ambiguity of that solution, of the richness of the solutions that there exist. regarding the global hyperbolicity, let me emphasize again what that means. It means something very specific in case you want to solve the Klein-Gordon equation on such a space-time. If your space-time is globally hyperbolic, and we believe that our actual space-time is globally hyperbolic, if you have such a space-time and you pick one Cauchy surface, what does that mean? It means you pick a point in time, and then, so that's an event, and then extend that event as a space-like hypersurface throughout the universe. So you take a snapshot of the universe at a particular point in time according to your definition of what is equal time. And there are many definitions for what is equal time. But a space-like hypersurface has, of course, to be such that any tangent vector to the space-like hypersurface is actually space-like. So any two events on such a space-like hypersurface must be space-like to each other. Okay, so let's assume that we have chosen a space-like hypersurface in our space-time. The dimension of it is what? If I choose a space-like hypersurface, for example, now, what dimension would that space-like hypersurface have? Any guesses?
Space-time minus one.
Exactly, three. Right? So it's actually a volume. It's a snapshot in time of our 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. It's actually a volume, right? Okay, so I choose one of those. And now imagine that I'm given the initial conditions to for the Klein-Gordon equation, the second order. Then I can calculate what the Klein-Gordon equation does with these initial conditions all the way to the future and all the way to the past. And what that means is that I can specify a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation either by writing it down explicitly as a phi of x and t or as a mode function u of x and t. I can write it down explicitly, or I can also just fix it and its derivative on the space-like hypersurface. And that also fixes the solution, because the equation of motion then allows me to extend it into the past and into the future. We will need that a little later.
I have a side question. I don't know if it fits here, but so you said that for this to be true, we need space-time to not contain wormholes. Also, I heard that if you assume that you have assume that exotic matter exists and you have like a transversal wormhole, then
what and you have a one wormhole?
Transversible.
Transversible. Yeah.
Then the quantum fluctuations would conspire in a way to destroy this wormhole. But when I see this proposition, it looks like to me that we don't know how to consistently do quantum field theory in a space-time with a wormhole. So how does the statement?
Well, remember that we made a decision one or two lectures ago that we will treat the space-time as a given. And you will only study how the space-time affects the quantum fields that live on it. Only much later in the course will we encounter the need to also consider how the quantized field feeds back and affects the space-time. So at the moment, our field is not going to close wormholes or anything like that, because it's not going to act back onto the space-time.
But there's the point. I mean, according to what I'm seeing here, the field cannot can even act in a space-time with a wormhole. If you give me space-time with a wormhole,
yes.
Like we don't know how to define a field in it.
Well, if you have a wormhole that only allows you to travel to the future, you might be able to get away with it. But you can't perform, I should say, I mean, just to be completely accurate, what we need is that the space-time is globally hyperbolic in order to perform quantization this way.
Okay.
You see, it could be that unbeknownst to us, space-time is not globally hyperbolic. And of course, it's still that everything that we know of is quantized. So there will be some way to do it. There is some way that quantum gravity works. We don't know that how that works.
But
this method requires it.
But then my question would be, is there a method that we know that?
Maybe if you have wormholes that do not spoil the global hyperbolicity. You see, you could have a wormhole that allows you to travel into the future, but not into the past.
But with a full-time machine that allows me to do whatever.
No, then you couldn't do it. No, the quantization of that. There are attempts at that. For example, Deutsch has some ideas and techniques for quantizing in spite of that. It's essentially applying a consistency condition on the density operator of a system that goes back into the past and forward so that the whole thing is self-consistent. But you can't calculate as much as we can calculate here.
I was going to say, Deutsch did write a paper about quantum spooky effects on closed-time.
It's essentially a consistency condition.
It's very ad hoc. It's like, I insert this, I enforce that time is now treated specially.
Okay, so let's see. Let's prove that we can carry the whole thing through under this assumption. So let's consider the vector space V of all real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation on our space-time. So for now, just the real-valued solutions. And we do know that they form a vector space because The Klein-Gordon equation doesn't have a potential in it. So the Klein-Gordon equation is linear in phi, and therefore the linear combination of solutions is also a solution. Okay, so let's say we consider, we call V the space, the vector space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And then we define a bilinear form on that vector space. So that's a product where you can plug in two solutions and you get out a number. It's bilinear. It's linear in the first and linear in the second. Namely, if F is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and H is also a real-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, so F and H are in the vector space V, then we define the following number, namely the inner product between F and H. It's a kind of inner product, but you will see there's something up with it. And what is that number? For that, we choose any one, any space-like hypersurface in the space-time, any Cauchy surface in the space-time. You know, that's one of those surfaces, that's one of these points in time where we could set initial conditions. And we integrate over that space-like hypersurface this integrand. Square root of g, g, mu nu, and then that expression here. An expression that you might recognize from up here. It looks very similar to it, except that here we have complex conjugation as well. Here we don't, because it's just real-valued functions. We will have to come back to the complex-valued case. But in principle, this is very similar to what we have here. Now, with the square root of g, g mu nu, same thing, and then function, derivative, function, and function, derivative, function. But we have two different functions, right? It's f and g. Here we have u and u star. So if we take any two solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, we can plug them in here and integrate this over. The only thing we need to know is what is the solution on the space-like hypersurface and what's the derivative of the solution, or what are the derivatives of the solution on that space-like hypersurface. And then we can integrate all of that up. The number that we get out of this is very special. Because if we calculated this expression on a different hyperbolic, on a different hypersurface, we would get the same number out of it. We would get the same number out of it, as one can show, and we will later go through that calculation. We get the same number, and the reason is that if I know a function, I mean, if I know a solution's value and a solution's derivatives on one of those Cauchy surfaces, then I can calculate what the value of the function and its derivative is later and earlier. So I can calculate from just the data on the Cauchy surface what the data on any other Cauchy surface would be, and using Stokes' theorem and the Klein-Gordon equation, one can calculate that and prove that this product, this bilinear form, gives us the same number no matter where we calculate it. You may know that if you've done some differential equation theory, you may know the Wronskian, and this is a Wronskian. It's a generalized Wronskian here. So the proposition is that the bilinear form evaluated in this way, is its value is actually independent of the choice of hypersurface sigma on which we calculate it. For the proof, later. Now, the bilinear form f and f, h is not actually an inner product. It is what is called a symplectic form. It has the property that f, h is minus h, f. Because if you swap, if f and h are made to swap places here, you get the same thing up to a minus sign. So this thing is anti-symmetric. And what can we do with something that's not a quadratic form, but is anti-symmetric like this? If it was a symmetric thing, then it would be a Hermitian operator that we can diagonalize. But it's not. It's anti-symmetric. Is there a way that we can diagonalize, in some sense, a symplectic form? And the answer is yes, kind of, but it's not the usual kind of diagonalization. This was addressed by Darboux. And Darboux showed that for any non-degenerate symplectic form, the symplectic form that has no zeros as eigenvalues, for any non-degenerate symplectic form, there exists a basis in the vector space such that in this basis, the symplectic form is not quite diagonal, but it's almost diagonal. It has these 2x2 submatrices on the diagonal. It's a 0, 1, minus 1, 0. 0, 1, minus 1, 0. It has to be anti-symmetric, right? Because the whole thing is anti-symmetric. And all the other off-diagonals are just vanishing. It's a bit analogous to the diagonalization of a symmetric inner product, which we can always diagonalize, and then we get some eigenvalues, and they have different sizes, and so on, and they will be real valued. And here, because it's anti-symmetric, it's a different story. We can't properly diagonalize. We only get this sort of almost diagonalization. And there's no eigenvalues to speak of. It's just 1 and minus 1 that occur in these little boxes there. So what that means is that in our vector space of real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, we have, we can find, this is guaranteed by Darboux's theorem, we can find the basis Vn such that the V with the with an even index, comma a V with the same even index plus 1 gives us a 1, that's this. And the V with an odd index, comma the V with the next lower even index is a minus 1. That's this minus 1, and that just repeats for all n. This is just a complicated way of saying this. And all other pairings vanish. So again, this is not really like the, it's the analog of what would be the orthonormalization of eigenvectors of a Hermitian matrix, where they would be orthogonal, right? But here what we have is pairs of solutions. And they have this symplectic product of 1 and minus 1, depending on which way you put that. Now that we have a basis in our vector space of real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, we can take any arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So we can take any arbitrary vector in this vector space, any arbitrary solution. And since the V's, by Darboux's theorem, form a basis, every arbitrary solution is a linear combination of these basis solutions. So for example, if A and B are solutions, then A is a sum over coefficients A and Vn, and B is a sum of coefficients B and Vn. And then we can calculate the symplectic product of the two solutions A and B by plugging that in here. And we obtain that the symplectic product of the two solutions A and B can be calculated in this way, where A are the linear expansion coefficients of the solution A in the basis, in the Darboux basis, and the B are the linear expansion coefficients of the vector B in that Darboux basis. And that's convenient because now, in order to calculate the symplectic product between two solutions, we don't have to integrate over a hypersurface anymore. Instead, what we can do is we can just take our solution, expand it in terms of this basis of solutions, and then the from the expansion coefficients, we can calculate what the symplectic product is of these two. Now remember that this symplectic product of two solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, two real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, looks very much like what we need here for our Runskin, but it's not the same because here we have complex conjugation and here we don't. So in order to fix this, let's build on what we have and let's consider now the space of complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. So let's assume we picked a Dabu basis in our space V of real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we define V bar to be the vector space of complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We have a Dabu basis for V. Let's see if we can find a convenient basis for V bar. And of course, we can easily build a convenient basis from the Vn's. Because the Vn's, obviously, are themselves already elements of V bar. Because being real valued, they're also complex valued. But if we actually want a basis of V bar, then the V's are not good enough. Because we need some imaginary components too. So let's try this. Let's take the real valued basis vectors, basis functions, and we take the v2n plus I times the v2n plus 1. You know, these are the two functions that correspond to one of these little boxes there. And then for convenience, 1 over square root of 2, that's for normalization later on. We call this un. So the un now is, of course, also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, but it's a complex-valued one now. And the un star is obtained from this one just by complex conjugation, so we pick up a minus sign here. So for any two real-valued solutions, we now obtain two complex-valued solutions. And now we can ask, well, what is a natural product on the space of complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation? Well, the natural product is the one that we want, the one that is in our Runskin up here, right? Like this one here. So we define for complex-valued solutions, we define as their product exactly what we need here, which is square root of g, g mu nu, square root of g, g mu nu, and then we have function star times the derivative of the function minus derivative function star h. That's exactly this, where we put the I also over here on the left-hand side. I mean, we don't know yet whether or not this is going to be a Dirac delta or anything. We're just trying to construct here something. We're trying to find out something about the left-hand side, and we find it convenient to define the I right into here. So we plug it over here. You see, these two terms are swapped compared to those terms, and that gives us a minus sign, and that's because we want to move that I over here. So what we define now is this inner product, not inner product really, but this product between two complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We know it's independent of which space-like hypersurface we calculate it on. And we can work out what this is if we plug in the basis functions. If we plug in the basis functions f, for f and h, we plug in a un and the un star, or a un and a um. Then we can work out what that is, because we already worked out what the product is between the vn's and the vm's. And we can reduce everything to what we already did for the vn's. And when you sub all of that in and evaluate it, then you find that the product between I mean, this edgy product here between the complex valued solutions is actually having this behavior here, which is not a symplectic form. What we have is that the inner product between the UNs and the UMs is minus the delta, Kronecker delta of N and M. So they have to be equal. The indices have to be equal and gives us a minus one. And for the start ones, if they're equal, they gives us a plus, that gives us a plus one. And if they're unequal, it's a zero. And between the U's and the U stars, we always have a zero. It's a little calculation that you might want to do yourself to verify. What this means is that the product between the F and H, the product between the complex valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, are almost an inner product. Almost an inner product, but not quite. You see, it's an indefinite inner product because it can actually be also negative. See, you could have that F with F is something negative. If it was a true inner product, it would give us the length. That would have to be positive. But it's a bit like in special relativity, right, where an invariant distance can be negative. An invariant distance squared can be negative. And so what we have is that if we choose a Dabu basis for this product, then we obtain that our V star is of this diagonal, actual diagonal form, where the upper half of the diagonal is all minus ones, and the lower half of the diagonal, and it goes on forever, right, infinitely many, is all plus ones. So it's almost an inner product space, except that it's indefinite. It's not positive definite, it's indefinite because it has negative and positive outcomes. But nevertheless, we can still use this fact to write a resolution of the identity on our space of, on our vector space of complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Namely, using this notation here with these edgy brackets, where it is understood to be this, we can write the identity operation on the space of solutions to complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We can write the identity operation in this way, where these brass and cats are not quantum mechanical Hilbert space brass and cats. They are vectors that have a product of this edgy bracket kind. So we can write the identity as the sum over these basis vectors and these basis vectors, but those need a minus sign now. You see, if this whole thing had been a proper inner product space, where the inner product is always positive, we wouldn't need the minuses here. We would just have a regular resolution of the identity as in ordinary quantum mechanics. But we get the minus sign here. Let's check this. So, what do we have? If we apply this claim to be identity, resolution of the identity, if we apply this to UN, then we obtain the UN again. See, you apply a UN to a UN, then this is the inner product, or not, it's just a product between a UN star and a UN. If you apply a UN from the right, this will vanish because of that. Right? The product between any UN and any UN star is always vanishing, so that's going to go away. And then we have the product between the UN from the left and the UN from the right. That gives us a minus 1. And that kills this minus 1, and we just get the UN back. So we've just shown that this is true. And now if we apply this resolution of the identity on a UN star, then if there's a UN star on the right, it will kill that term, because UN star, a UN with a UN star always gives us a zero. And here we get the UM with the UN. And that just gives us a 1 here. I mean, that's a sum, right? And it just gives us the Kronecker delta. And we end up with just the UN star. So therefore, this is really a resolution of the identity. And this means that for any f in the space of complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, so for any function, any complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, we have that it can be expanded in this way. That is to say, we have that if we apply the identity here on f, then we get f back. Now, if we take that equation, that this is the identity, or that we apply it on f, we get f back. This is just written in a very abstract form. But we can spell out what these products are, right? So we can spell out what that is. If we take the UN star and apply it on f, what that really is that we have to integrate over some Cauchy surface, you know, UN star times derivatives of f minus the UN and then f star, I mean, UN differentiate f and so on. You know, it's the expression that we get. It's this Wronskian expression that we get in practice. It's just a very simple way of writing something that's actually a little complicated, right? But if we do that, if we spell all of that out, what we obtain is that this resolution of the identity, when written in, when spelled out what that is, on space-time, choosing a Cauchy surface, and then using that it has to be true for all f, then we obtain that that equation is actually this one, which is our Wronskian condition. Remember, that's the condition that the mode functions have to obey, such that the canonical commutation relations are obeyed. Remember, that was the sticking point at the end. We have to find solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, which when we take infinitely many of them and sum them up and do all of this stuff, it ends up being the Dirac delta. And what we just did is define, we constructed the Dabu basis among the real valued solutions, and then combined them to get complex valued solutions, and then showed that these solutions summed up in this way give us a resolution of the identity. And the resolution of the identity equation, namely that you apply that identity on f equal to f, that equation turns out to be, in practice, as we will show now, to be just the equation that's needed to solve our problem. In other words, in order to complete our quest to second quantize the Klein-Gordon theory, what we need to do is solve the Klein-Gordon equation, find all of its solutions, and then do a Dabu diagonalization of that space of that symplectic product on the space of solutions. And once we have the Dabu basis among in the space of real valued solutions, we can combine these real valued solutions into complex valued solutions in exactly this way here. And those UN functions are called UN for a reason. Namely, they turn out to be exactly those mode functions that we need in order for the canonical commutation relations to be obeyed. So if we calculate the Dabu basis and then combine the basis vectors in this way, and then use these complex valued functions of space and time, these complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, in our ansatz for the solution of the quantum field theoretical quantization, then we will succeed because the canonical commutation relations hold. Okay, so let's see. We take the product between F and H. We can evaluate that on any Cauchy surface we want. And it's always this expression by definition. Remember, this is with the edgy brackets. So these F and G are general complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. And then in a suitable coordinate system, we can spell this out explicitly. And this integration over the space-like hypersurface becomes then, in an explicit coordinate system, it becomes an integration over space only, holding time fixed.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question about what we just did. So we started with a symplectic structure, constructed our root basis. I think the last thing is complexification, where you...
Yeah.
So the symplectic structure arises because of the preservation of commutation relations.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bosonic field theory. What is the same procedure for a fermionic thing where you want to preserve the anti-commutation?
Yes. Now, that's the quantization of fermions on curved space-time is quite different and highly non-trivial.
What is the structure that arises? It's not symplectic.
It should be a matrix, right?
It should be what?
Should be a matrix instead of a symplectic form.
What you mean is a symmetric instead of anti-symmetric, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right, so the claim is that the general formulation of this edgy product here in an explicit coordinate system, there's always an explicit coordinate system, namely where we choose a point in time and then integrate over space in order to get our space-like hypersurface, where this inner product, this product takes this particular form. Where, as I said, we hold time fixed and we just integrate over space. And then we get here the G naught nu because it's just in the time direction. Right. And we see then from equation P, that's the application of the resolution of the identity. So resolution of the identity applied to an arbitrary complex valued solution F is giving us the F back. We use this and that to see that the resolution of the identity equation here becomes, when spelled out explicitly, so we are just spelling out what these things are using that. It becomes this expression here, where you know we have the UN F and we have the UN star F, and here we have these expressions. At this point, we interchange the two operations. We are assuming here that this is legal, that we interchange the summation over the n with the integration over the sigma. I do not know of cases where this is critical, where this could be non-trivial, but it's something perhaps to keep in mind if you want to quantize in wild circumstances, that some non-trivial stuff might occur here. So what we will do is we assume that we can interchange the summation over the mode functions with the integration over space, over the space-like hypersurface. And when we do that, we get the integration outside and the summation inside. So we have the summation inside, and from up here, right. From here, we then obtain that that for all f, because remember in these calculations, the f was an arbitrary solution, we obtain that this expression here with the f pulled out now of all the expressions is equal to f again. This is all we did is, and it's a little tedious, you may need a minute to look at that closely. All we did is that we took the abstract equation and plugged in the concrete formulation for those products in terms of integrations over the hypersurface. We obtained that this integral over that applied to f is equal to f again. But you see, if that's true for all f, then it must be true that when we remove the integral, that that the integrand is going to be a Dirac delta. Another way to look at it is you could also functionally differentiate with respect to f. If you functionally differentiate with respect to f of y and t, then you get a Dirac delta d3 here, and you get a Dirac delta here as well of y minus x prime, and that Dirac delta then will be eaten up by the integral. And what we obtain then is overall this expression here. Here I spelled it out in a little bit more detail, how that works out. Do you want to see all that detail? Because it's a little tedious. But you see, the overall message is that what we have to do is to, what we have to do in order to complete the second quantization of the field is calculate a Dabou basis in the space of real-valued solutions to the Kein-Gordon equation, and then we can compose the basis, the Dabou basis vectors in pairs to obtain complex-valued solutions to the Kein-Gordon equation. And these complex-valued solutions give us a resolution of the identity. And the resolution of the identity equation is the equation, is the Wronskian condition for preserving the canonical commutation relations, for fulfilling the canonical commutation relations. And therefore, these complex solutions that are linear combinations of the real-valued solutions that we obtain by Dabou diagonalization, those can be used to solve our quantum field theory. So here's written up again. Conclusion so far, we need to fulfill the canonical commutation relations, the Hermiticity condition, and the equations of motion. We make this ansatz and define the canonical conjugate momentum like that. We keep the canonical commutation relations between the A and the A dagger. And then we need, in order to fulfill the canonical commutation relations, the Hermiticity and the equations of motion are given with the ansatz already. But in order to get the canonical commutation relations right, we need to find mode functions u that obey that, and they are obtained by Dabou diagonalization. So, Peter, do you have a question?
Well, you know the structure that gives us the Dirac delta with the Wronskian, that doesn't involve in an integral in the usual way that we have in continuous spaces in ordinary quantum mechanics. But we know that because that takes, for example, in this case, it takes gx prime to gx over the d3x integral, then I can say that that's the Dirac delta through everything that we did before.
I'm not sure what point you want to make. You say there's no integral here?
What I mean is there's a sigma and not like an actual integral, which is...
Oh, yeah, right, that's right.
In ordinary quantum mechanics, we have like the whole integral and the continuous spaces, and then that will be your, that will then be your resolution of the identity, and that will give you the Dirac delta. But here we have actually an infinite.
Yes, but you can have that in quantum mechanics as well. You can have that too. And the reason is that, as a good observation, but here's how this goes. If you Consider ordinary Fourier theory. What's the Fourier transform of the Dirac delta? The Fourier transform of the Dirac delta shows that the Dirac delta has all frequencies, and it has them at equal amplitude. Different phases depending on where the Dirac delta sits, but all same amplitude. Now imagine that you have, and that's a Fourier transform, right? And so you can write the Dirac delta as a sum of plane waves, because that's what the Fourier transform gives. In fact, if you just take a plane wave and integrate it over, you get a Dirac delta, 2 pi Dirac delta, that's what you get. But remember that if you want to consider only functions on a finite interval, let's say from minus pi to pi or so, then you can also do Fourier theory.
Series.
You can do Fourier series. And now imagine you have your Dirac delta that's sitting there, somewhere in that interval. You can still express it, but now you have just a discrete sum of these plane waves. So that's possible as well. Now, in our case here, the K, of course, doesn't have to be anything related to Fourier. All we know is that we need infinitely many of them, because these are going to be ordinary solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that are not supposed to be distributional. They're supposed to be smooth. And therefore, we need infinitely many of them in order to be able to linearly combine them into a Dirac delta. They also have to be complex valued, as we saw, because otherwise these two terms would be the same, and therefore the left-hand side would be zero. Now, the Dabu theory is great because it provides us with an existence, with a guarantee of the existence of Dabu bases, and therefore of these complex valued solution bases that fulfill this. However, what is also known is that unlike the diagonalization of a Hermitian operator, which is unique up to phases in front of the eigenvectors, right? You can always multiply them with a phase and they're still orthonormalized. For a Dabu basis, there is no uniqueness of that kind. Instead, there are infinitely many Dabu bases that you can find. And they're not trivially related just by phases to each other. In fact, they can be highly non-trivially related to each other. And there's nothing in this formalism that would have told us which Dabu bases to choose. It only told us there are Dabu bases. Choose one, and then pairwise take these real-valued solutions to create complex-valued solutions, and those are the mode functions that you can use. But then that would seem to give us lots of different ways of quantizing the theory. And so that's what we will deal with next time, namely to tame that infinity of choices. We will have to ask, well, are they all equally good, these choices? What's the difference in the physics if I choose the one or the other Dabu basis? And how come that in Minkowski space we didn't encounter that ambiguity? Or could we encounter it? Is there Minkowski space also sometimes a situation where we may not want to do the quantization as we did it before, but maybe we should choose another Dabu basis and calculate from there? And the answer is yes, that sometimes even in Minkowski space, we should use a different basis. For example, if you're an accelerated observer, then for you, a different basis might be the appropriate one. But what is an appropriate basis anyway? So these are the questions that we will next address. Okay, any more questions about today? You were first, Sipe.
So would that be some kind of a Bogoliubov transformation?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
You get from one to the other method of quantization through a Bogoliubov transformation.
Okay, but but it wouldn't have the exact same structure as the one you showed with the in and out and with the J knot. So it would be a little bit different.
Yes, it would be a little different. That's right. Yeah, and it will mix the A's and the A daggers in general.
Is there a literature on the Fermionic case or somewhere you can direct us to?
Let me see. Where might that be? Offhand, I don't even know any textbook that does that. I think Birrell and Davis doesn't do it. In fact, you will find very few textbooks that even do it this way with a Dabu basis. They do it carefully. I know this because I was TAing a course on quantum field theory in Cambridge when I was a postdoc. And so I had to learn that stuff, and it was in the lecture notes of...
whose lecture was it?
Stewart. Maybe in the book by Stewart. That's right. He wrote a book on GR. It may be in there. Osborne, he was also teaching it. Generally, things are somewhat swept under the carpet. And they just say, oh, this works, so let's do it. Yes, but what else works? And how do we know this works? And so for that, you have to go through this business with a Dabu basis. Yeah, I don't think Birrell and Davis has it. Mukhanov-Vinitsky doesn't have it. I don't know. Okay, so let's officially close the lecture, and you're welcome to ask more questions then.